From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with local author Sarah Ward, whose new novel is Aesop Lake, published by Green Writers Press. Sarah Ward writes young adult fiction, poetry, and journal articles in the field of child welfare. Over a 25-year career as a social worker, Sarah has worked with young adults and families with harrowing backgrounds. She won the 2007 Editor's Choice Award for her poem Warmer Waters, which appeared in the New England Anthology of Poetry, and she has been a member of the League of Vermont Writers since 2008. She lives with her husband in Williston, Vermont, and in her limited spare time, Sarah enjoys a good book, a little yoga, and a cup of tea. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Aesop Lake, and then Sarah and I are going to speak live here in the studio, which is exciting. So Aesop Lake is published, as I said, by Green Writers Press. One warm May night at the town reservoir, 17-year-old Lita Keough sees her boyfriend do something awful. She wants to forget it ever happened, but David needs her to be his alibi and is willing to destroy her family if she refuses. Trapped, Lita must choose between truth, her boyfriend, and her family. Jonathan Tanner Eales feels like an outsider. He's gay, and life in rural Vermont hasn't been as idyllic as he hoped it would be. When Jonathan and his boyfriend Ricky are attacked during a night swim, Jonathan manages to escape, but he must watch helpless as Ricky is beaten. Jonathan, plagued by trauma and fear, wrestles with anger and shame in the aftermath of the crime. That summer, Lita and Jonathan are swept together by chance, and both must reckon with fundamental questions of loyalty and courage. Aesop Lake is structured using Aesop fables, usually taught to children in elementary school. Young adults who are faced with the challenge of making ethical and moral decisions every day can find a connection to the characters and the familiar tales of Aesop. So I want to welcome Sarah Ward to Write the Book.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. I'm looking forward to talking about this book, and I am happy that you're open to reading from the book. So I think what we will do to start is have you read an excerpt from Aesop Lake, and maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what you're about to read.
Sure. So I'm going to read from the second chapter, which is from Jonathan Tanner Eales' perspective. This is just at the beginning of the crime that happens at the lake, at the reservoir. So this is Jonathan speaking. I hear a blast, and something ricochets off the rock next to Ricky's back. I'm so confused. I hear hollering in the distance, and then screaming in my ear. I look down. It's coming from Ricky. Someone is yelling, something about queers, but I can't understand it. I can't make out any faces, just the shape of two people. I grab Ricky's hand and pull him into the water, his legs moving like the Tin Man. Are you okay? I ask. Ricky's face is terror-stricken. His eyes are bulging and he stares straight ahead. Come on, we have to swim away now. I try to pull Ricky into the deeper water. His arms and legs will not move. The White Witch has turned him to stone. He just stands there, knee-deep. I'm going to teach two queens a lesson, a voice declares, moving closer. Jesus, Ricky, we have to get out of here. Someone is coming. We have to swim away. I plead, but nothing snaps Ricky out of it. Hot tears run down my cheeks. Desperation clutches my heart. I have seen enough movies to know this is not going to end well. Leave us alone, I shout towards the voices. I reach out and slap Ricky across the face. Maybe it will shake him into action. Another shot. And I feel sharp pain in my thigh and butt like bee stings. My hands instinctively move over my crotch. My thigh is numb. Ricky begins to shake uncontrollably. He is the lamb waiting for the wolf. Someone stands at the edge of the reservoir, and I can see the barrel of a gun pointed in our direction. Another guy moves quickly into the water towards us and reaches out. He grabs Ricky's arm from his statue of a body.
Thank you for reading that. I'm going to actually have us, let's just move these a tiny bit. That'd be great. Thank you. Sorry, guys, that was a little bit of noise there, but I want to be able to see Sarah while I speak to her. I want to be able to hear her. Thank you for reading that. And I'm just going to mention again, that was Sarah Ward reading from Aesop Lake, which is published by Green Writers Press. So, Sarah, I thought maybe we would start our conversation with your talking a little bit about how your years as a social worker prepared you for your career as a YA author. I think that's a really interesting combination of backgrounds.
Thanks. Yes, I have primarily focused my career in social work in child welfare. So okay. Most of my work has been either directly connected to kids who are in foster care or working with families, children and families when I was much younger, mm-hmm. With families who were struggling with child abuse, substance abuse, challenges like that.
Right.
And then over the past 20 years, I've been doing more training and education in the field of child welfare. I right now oversee the training program for the state's child welfare system.
Oh, wow. Okay. Great. That's. I have a question about this later, but one aspect of this book that I thought was really appropriate and relevant is one of the main characters, Lita. Is it Lita or Leda?
Lita.
Yeah. So her family has some real economic struggles, and that affects the choices that they make. And I thought that must have been something you saw a lot of in your work.
Yeah, I think it's reality, right? That there are a lot of families who try to do the best they can to make ends meet, and sometimes they make choices that are not the healthiest choices of ways to put together the budget, right? To make ends meet. And sometimes they do something that is not necessarily legal, but they try to kind of come up with reasonable, like, how else can I survive? Because there's nothing else I can do. And whether that involves drugs or selling something illegally or participating in some way in something that is not really above the board. I think a lot of families try to manage and have to make hard decisions.
Yeah. What was, if there was any one thing, sometimes I ask this question and people say, well, I don't know, I just woke up this morning and it was in my head, but what was your inspiration for writing Aesop Lake?
Oh, there are actually a number of things that sort of culminated into this story. I think part of the story started, there was an incident that had occurred where I had read this article where this young man had been beaten up for being gay, and his school had sort of held this sit-in afterwards, and they were like, we're not going to tolerate this. And it got me thinking, like, well, what would it be like if it was not like that, right? If the school was actually not a safe place where the community, I think we sort of live in a little bit of a bubble here in Chittenden County.
Yeah.
But I do feel like there are a lot of rural communities where it isn't okay to be different or to, you know, express something other than what is considered the norm. Mm-hmm. And I also, my daughter is gay, and she was also struggling with her own challenges around talking about who she was and her identity, and questioning at the time when this story started coming together. And she certainly had some experiences where I was like, oh, like, this is real. Mm-hmm. And kids are not necessarily given the tools to think about how to accept each other and how to be open to differences or diversity in any way, particularly in our very sort of white, heterosexual, you know, rural communities where people just expect everyone kind of is the same.
Right. Right.
And so I think it can be really challenging. And I just love this age group. And I was talking to a lot of kids at the time. I have been a youth group leader for a number of years in my fellowship. And so I just really love that grappling that young adults do. And the story just sort of came from there.
That's great. When you're talking about the makeup of these communities, I think that if you don't see anybody who looks different or acts different from you, yeah. then that is always something that creates fear, and fear can create a lot of animosity.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful story to address. Let's talk a little bit about the fables, Aesop fables, using this as a framing structure. How did that? Oh, actually, and before we even say anything else, you just mentioned your daughter, and I'm wondering if she did the illustrations.
She did,
in the book.
Yeah. So Lindsay did those. She did a great job.
Yeah, those are great too. Okay, so let's talk about the fables and using that as a framing.
Yeah.
Structure.
So I have actually always really enjoyed stories or parables that sort of have a message, and I feel like we do that in our culture all the time, mm-hmm. right? We use stories, and many cultures do have stories that sort of guide kids into adulthood about morality and ethics. And
right.
And I often feel like we lose some of this. You know, not everybody teaches it this way. Certainly lots of religions use their own religious stories. But I really feel like Aesop Fables is one of those things that my kids read when they were young. And then as you get older, we've sort of lose that
right.
Connection. And so to me, it just seemed like something kids could relate to. They might remember those fables from when they were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really use them. I try not to use them in a way that preaches, but more of
right.
just a frame of like, you know, here's something to consider, to think about.
Right. Something familiar.
Yeah.
Like a refrain from the distant memory.
Yeah.
That might help
exactly.
you. Yeah. It's funny. I remember early in the show's life, I interviewed Elizabeth Blumley, who was at the time one of the owners of Flying Pig Bookstore. Actually, mm-hmm. I guess she still is. Josie, I think, isn't. But anyway, so Elizabeth Blumley is also herself a children's author. And so I asked her at one point to tell me, you know, some of her favorite children's stories. And she started naming them. And I was like, oh, my God, I remember that. I remember
yeah.
that one. You know, and they do. They come back to
yeah.
you even if you haven't thought about them in years and years.
Yeah.
So that's really fun. So how did you find and develop Lita's and Jonathan's characters? Did those come really easily to you? Did you ever have any other point of view that you decided wasn't going to be a good narrator for your story?
Yeah, that's sort of funny you asked that question. I did. It was originally written with three points of view.
Okay.
Yeah, I had originally written it with actually Jonathan's mother, Marcia,
uh-huh.
was one of the points of view in the original draft.
Right.
And then my editor, Rose, who did a wonderful job with it, but she said, I really think you should drop the mom out of the view. She
uh-huh.
said, this is YA. I think Lita and Jonathan can really tell the story better. And I went right to Lindsay, right, who was sort of my go-to, and said, what do you think? Because she had read most of it. And she said, yeah, I think she's right. She's
yeah.
like, I think you could let that go and it would be stronger.
Right.
And so what it did, even though, you know, it meant cutting 10 chapters and writing four more and all of those
it's
things
so
that you have to do.
It's so hard to let go of that stuff, too.
Yeah. But it also really strengthened both Jonathan and Lita
yeah.
as narrators of the story. And it really allowed Jonathan's history and his voice and his perspective to come out so much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a good move.
I think, too, that way you can still, I mean, Marcia's still a very strong character mm-hmm. because we see her through his eyes, right?
Right.
And that's a really interesting dynamic. Ooh, sorry, that is inexcusable. So sorry. Let's talk about that. I wanted to talk a little bit about children parenting their parents. And that is a sort of subtle theme in this story. But both of your main characters have mm-hmm. some aspect of this in the way that they have to take care of their parents. Now, Jonathan mm-hmm. sort of protects his mom from the truth
right.
of his high school experience. He's bullied at school, and he does not want her to know how bad it is. He doesn't want her to suffer thinking
right.
about what he goes through. And then Lita, who's our other narrative point of view character, has to protect her own mother in a much more sort of real, gritty way. Her mom is the person I mentioned earlier in the interview who, because of their economic situation, has had to make some difficult choices, and I think she makes wrong choices but doesn't have a lot of them to choose from. And she has gotten into a situation where she breaks the law in order to make ends meet. She steals medications from some of her nursing mm-hmm. patients to sell or through it. A person who wants to sell them on the side. And Lita is very afraid that this secret can get out if she doesn't protect her boyfriend. I hope you don't mind that I've just told that part of the plot, but it's pretty early on that we learn that.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
Both of these kids have to protect their parents in one way or another. And I wondered if that just sort of came out organically as you wrote, or if you intended for that to be a message.
It definitely did come out organically, and I think that it is so much the narrative of kids I have worked with,
right,
and family situations that I've, you know, been involved with as a social worker, mm-hmm. that often our youth feel like the weight of the world is on their shoulders,
right,
and that they are responsible for really big decisions, and that their actions will impact their whole family.
Yes.
And I think that that's so real for kids. And I think it just sort of grew out of that, knowing that that is what kids often feel like. They can't say what's really going on for them because the impact is so huge.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the information that you needed to be familiar with in order to write this book. I'm sure that your daughter helped you quite a lot, but you needed to know about LGBTQ life for young mm-hmm. people. You needed to know about what's going on in high schools at this point in time,
sure.
As far as acceptance or lack thereof. There's some police procedure in the book, not a ton, but some.
A little bit.
And then obviously teens and hate crimes. I feel like you probably had to do a little bit of research in these areas. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that aspect of writing the novel.
The, sort of the research piece.
The research,
yeah.
Like, where did you turn when you didn't know anything about a certain thing or something about something that you know maybe a little bit about?
Yeah, I certainly my young adults were super helpful who are in my life. I have two daughters, one who's 21 and one who is 18.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were certainly, you know, really helpful in talking through situations. Mm-hmm. Is this realistic? That kind of thing. Dialogue, words, language. I did utilize friends who, a spouse of one colleague whose husband was a police officer.
Mm. Just it's so helpful.
Yeah, so helpful, right? Having connections to, he had a lot of like bullying PowerPoints and things, information about mm-hmm. what is taught in schools, mm-hmm. Thinking about, you know, what are the laws. I did write to the Commissioner of Human Rights and asked her a bunch of questions, like, how would this be charged? Would it be charged as a hate crime? What does that look like versus, you know, something that is just a violent act against someone, because mm-hmm. it's a much harsher penalty if it's a hate crime.
Right.
And so I did some research there and did a lot of reading, but the most important research pieces were really actual conversations and, you know, email interviews that I did with people to say, like, how would this play out?
Yeah.
And that really helped.
Now, you don't, in the book that I recall, I'm not remembering any moment where there is bullying that's done with the aid of the computer or internet mm-hmm. or social media. And I know that that's a huge problem when it comes to dealing with bullying in this age. Did you ever have an aspect of that included in the story, or did you decide that wasn't where you were going?
I just didn't go there.
Yeah.
I had different conversations with different people about what that would look like. It just would have taken me down such a different path.
Mm-hmm.
And it really felt, particularly since I was looking at rural America, you know, really not, even though this is a story located in rural Vermont,
mm-hmm.
I really wanted it to be a much broader audience.
Right.
And to understand that social media issues really vary across the country in terms of where it hits and what is actually happening to kids physically.
Right.
And so I guess that's, you know, where I really ended up landing. Like, I didn't want to distract from what happens face to face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's that's great to hear how you thought about that. It's true. I want to just mention before we continue on, this is Write the Book. You're listening from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington. We are streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. So you mention on the back cover of the book that teachers are encouraged to use the book in their classroom. So how is that being used? Have you seen anybody doing that yet?
Not yet. The book launches tomorrow.
Oh, right. Sure.
Out of Phoenix. We'll be at Phoenix in Burlington at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
Night.
Phoenix in Burlington.
Yep. And I do have in the back of the book a discussion guide and a resource, a list of resources, of online resources for kids or teachers, whomever.
Right. And I was thinking I would probably put those on the podcast site so that people can find them.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. So the discussion guide is really a conversation starter for how to really get some kids talking about how do you be an ally, right?
Yeah.
How do you step forward in when someone up here is feeling unsafe?
Yeah.
How do you help them out? How do you, I don't think we spend a lot of time really giving kids the tools that they need to stand up and, you know, we say support your friends and and be kind and be caring and all of those things. But when someone is actually being harassed or picked on or treated separately, you know, treated like an outsider for whatever reason, how do we actually, you know, teach and support our young adults to say, hey, like, that's not okay. How can I support you? And so my hope is that this will start some of those conversations and really give teachers some talking points to really think about what change does Lita have to go through in order to become an ally?
Right.
And what is it that Ricky and Jonathan needed? Not obviously after the hate crime, but even long before, when they were being harassed and treated poorly in school, like, what could someone have done? What could a peer do? Not wait for the adults, but what can you do?
Right, and it does nothing to afterwards say to your best friend, I can't believe he said that to her. I mean, that does nothing.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
Right.
But it's hard, too, because it's very intimidating. And at that age, there's more peer pressure to behave with the crowd.
To be a part of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think silence is sometimes is worse, right, than the person who is saying the horrible thing. It's like to have everyone else just ignore it or walk by and pretend like nothing is happening is almost worse for kids, because then they feel like nobody really cares.
Yeah. You have a character in the book. I was so pleased that Lita has a brother who is on her side, and that made me happy. So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about Keegan as a character and developing his character.
Yeah, Keegan really grew through the different renditions of this story. And I think I didn't even understand exactly how important he was until I got clear about where their father was and that he had passed away.
Right.
And once I understood that, I was like, oh, here is this young man who really ends up playing the big brother role in almost a fatherly way, right? And but really doesn't tell her what to do. He's really a brother.
Yeah.
But he does, he's there for her in a positive way. And I think that I just felt he needed to kind of grow also throughout the story. And she needed to see that happening, which helped her to grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked, too, that we got to see him grow as an individual apart from what was going on for her. I liked that, you know. Now, let's talk. You handled something in this that I've actually been dealing with a little bit in a book that I'm working on, and that is that your book takes place in two different locations. They're not drastically dissimilar locations. Right. It's not like taking a plane across the world. But how did that go for you? You had to establish one setting, and then you had to establish another setting.
Yeah, they're such clear places in my mind.
Oh, okay.
They're real places to me.
Yes.
So it was very easy for me to write about them as different. So there's a reservoir in the beginning, which to me is very much based on the Indian Brook Reservoir
okay.
in Essex.
Yeah.
And then the Aesop Lake really takes place in real life. There is a lake like this over in the Adirondacks.
Okay.
And it is a beautiful place and a beautiful camp. And I have been there, and I used to belong to a family friend, and so we have visited there, and the buildings are exactly as I described them. And so that to me was just like, it was there.
Okay.
It was real. So it was easy. And when I was there, it was quite a few years ago, but when I was there, I was like, oh, I have to have a book take place here. This is the perfect setting.
This would have been the perfect excuse to go back and take notes.
I know. If only they still owned it.
All right. Now let's see. Another issue that I think is really fun in any book, when I'm reading a book, if I've come across a really well-managed gesture, it seems like in so many books, everybody's just always nodding and smiling and shaking their head. And, you know, there's not a lot of unique gesture in fiction sometimes. And you have this great gesture, and I had to just mention it because Keegan is visiting Lita in her room. She's an artist. And they're talking, and while they're talking, he goes over to where she has her paint tubes and he starts squeezing, just sort of like, you know, kind of absentmindedly, but also to help her out. He squeezes the paint toward the opening of each tube. And I was like, that's a great gesture. I mean, there he is just, it was like so perfect for the scene. So do you, I do have a question here. Do you think a lot about gesture? Do you notice things in the world and take notes about them? Or does it come to you mostly when you're writing?
Well, truthfully, I'm not a super visual person.
Okay.
So I have to really, this is craft for me, mm-hmm. right? Like once you get the story down, I'm all about action and dialogue
yeah.
is what comes to me first.
Okay.
And then in the next round, then I'm like, okay, how do you make this?
Fill it in, yeah.
right? How do you put in the visuals? What is actually happening? My editor, again, she did a fantastic job of saying, what is actually happening here?
Yeah.
Or this really doesn't make sense. I can't see it.
Yeah.
What is happening? And she really just pushed me to get much more concrete
okay.
with actions and body language. And I think, you know, if you want a writing prompt, those are some of the best prompts you can do
yeah.
is to force yourself to write about body language, because those are the things that actually express a character
right.
in such a different way than what they say.
What's frustrating to me, though, it's funny, I used to take a lot of notes when I was maybe sitting in an airport during a layover, or, you know, sitting in a restaurant listening in to people or watching people. Everybody's on their phone all the time.
Right.
Like, this is the gesture
yeah.
of the modern world. It's so frustrating.
Yeah.
So,
it's
anyway.
True.
Okay, so we did talk a little bit about this before, but I want to talk a little bit more about how Lita and her mom have tension that is linked to the family's economic problems. And I wanted to know, you know, you said before that you try not to preach, and you don't want the Aesop fables to work as like a preachy device. So when you're writing and revising, are you aware of trying not to lecture to your readers? And the reason I'm bringing this up around the economic situation is, you know, obviously one thing that we take away from this story is that Lita's mom has made some big mistakes. Mm-hmm. So as you're writing, is it a challenge to educate within fiction while keeping the story readable and enjoyable and not preachy? Do you find yourself having to revise stuff a lot because you find, okay, well, that's kind of preachy?
I think to some extent, I think having other readers really helps with that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, not just an editor, but having other people. I had quite a few beta readers, both young adults and adults, who really gave me feedback mm-hmm. on, you know, you're using this character to get a point across, right? And that's not helpful.
Right.
Like, do it through action rather than having them say the perfect thing.
Right.
Right. Which is so easy to do.
Right.
And so I think it is a combination of both rewriting and being willing, but being open to feedback and mm-hmm. being open to people who read it and go, you know, this just is not working for me. And you need to back off.
Yeah.
And, you know, mom really can't know all the answers.
Right.
And, or Lita can't just come in and say, this is what I want you to do. Right.
Right.
So I think it is a combination. It takes a lot of, I mean, editing, as you know, is just it's the biggest part of writing a book. Getting that first draft out is great. And I do that usually through NaNoWriMo.
Yeah. Oh, well.
If, you know, I need that 1 month to just pound out a really horrible first draft and then feel like, okay, now I have a storyline and now I can start the work. And that's, you know, a couple of years to get it honed down to a place where you feel good.
Yeah. Now, do you outline before you start NaNoWriMo?
No.
No, you just
no,
let yourself.
In fact, I don't. I tried outlining a book once and I actually stopped writing the book.
Right.
Because it took away all the excitement for
yeah.
me. Like, I want to be as excited as you are reading
right.
it, right? Like, I want to see how this unfolds. And if my energy as the author is excited to see what's going to happen next, and I feel like those characters are carrying me down a path where, like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Then I'm like, wow, this is interesting,
yeah.
right? Then it's really got a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
When I outlined, I was like, oh, okay, so I know how the story ends. I don't really care anymore. I don't want to write it. So you just have to, you know, I've got to be as interested. If I'm going to, like, sit with a story, it's only a couple hundred pages long. If I'm going to spend 2 or 3 years on something, I better enjoy
yes.
every part of it.
Yeah. Now, do you ever find yourself going down the wrong path and saying, okay, yeah, this was interesting, but
yes.
This is not serving the story?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's just hard.
And sometimes it's hard to think this should be a good part of the story, and then it just doesn't work.
Right.
And you have to cut that or go in a different direction.
Right. Right. We already mentioned the setting changes at one point. And so the reason the setting changes is because Lita takes a job as a nanny for a little girl named Maddie. And I just loved the scenes between Maddie and Lita. Maddie's family owns this incredible compound mm-hmm. on a lake, all these different cabins. And that was just a really pleasurable part of the book for me, reading about the relationship between Maddie and Lita, reading about how Lita approached her work as a nanny and how much she loves Maddie, and mm-hmm. A few different moments in the book that just made me smile. So there's this moment where they play pool together.
Mm-hmm.
There's just all the details about them living together in a cabin, which must have been so exciting for Maddie to have, like, a special new older sister to live with in their own little house.
Yeah.
And then they do this great game of storming the castle where Lita just gets really into it, and it's super fun. So how did that plot come to you, or is there anything you can tell us about the way that developed? Because I thought it worked out really well, because then we get to see Lita also taking care of a little child and also losing herself in childhood again at a mm-hmm. point when she really could use to do that. But I have no idea if that's what you had in mind, or if you're just like, let's have some fun.
Yeah, I wish I could say there was some really well-planned reason for Maddie or that whole relationship. It felt very natural to me, and it felt like a very natural reason of why she would want to go away. Obviously, I had this great setting and I wanted a story to go there.
Right.
And so I needed to figure out, like, what would bring her there, right? She comes from economic hardship, a family that doesn't have a lot. How do you get her to a beautiful compound on this private lake?
Right.
And it was a natural way of sort of, okay, she could take a job there.
Yeah, that's what happens.
And that's what, right, that's what happens.
Sometimes certain people work for other people.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that also showed the economic difference between Lita and Jonathan. You know, she was the help.
Right.
And then Jonathan ending up there as a member of the family, extended family, was kind of, you know, why she wouldn't have known that, or it wouldn't be anything that would have prevented her. So without hopefully giving away too much of the
story. No, I don't
want
to give up too much. Although that's interesting now that you mention it, I'm thinking about the fact that the power dynamic between them changes so significantly because he is a victim at the beginning.
Right.
You know, he's not the main victim, but he's a victim. And then later, you know, he has to come to terms with the fact that he doesn't know her whole story.
Right.
And that changes the power dynamic, and that's really interesting.
And she doesn't know his story.
Right.
Right? Like, they know each other, but they don't really know
right.
each other. And they're really forced to kind of face who each person is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Oh, this is just another teeny tiny thing, but I loved this detail. Maddie, who's seven, she whispers around anything that you can't touch. This is such a great detail. It made me so happy. okay, let's see. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your publishing journey, finding your publisher.
Yeah, so this novel was pretty much ready to sort of take forward and start doing something with last summer.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, either going to start pitching it to agents or... and instead, I had an opportunity to enter it into a contest with When Words Count Retreat down in Rochester, Vermont. And Green Writers Press was the publishing house that if you won the contest, there were six participants, finalists, and you had to do a pitch, you had to do... put your manuscript together and give them a copy of your manuscript, and you had to come up with a cover design.
Mm-hmm.
And so you sort of provided the whole package and a marketing plan, and then they score you on all these different areas, and if you win, you get a publishing contract. And so that is how I ended up with Green Writers Press. And it was actually...
You buried the lead, so you won.
I did, yes. And that was a great fit for me, actually. I have really enjoyed the work with Dee Dee and Green Writers Press,
yes.
And it has felt very much like a good fit,
mm-hmm.
so that even had I not won this contest, I feel like I probably would have ended up with her. I just think they're great.
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay, that's great to know. So you never did sort of try to find an agent?
No, I was sort of right at that point. And then I was like, okay, here's an opportunity. Should I just go for it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had those discussions with my family, like, this is going to take some work to pull this off. Do we want to, you know, can you support me in getting through this? And they're like, let's do it.
Oh, that's fun. I love that they're so involved. That brings us back to the cover art and illustrations. So your daughter is Lindsay.
Yes.
And did they end up going with the cover art that you described in your plan?
They did.
Wow.
Yeah. So I did have Asha Hassan, who did the cover design. She did a fantastic job. I mean, I love the book cover. And I had two. She had designed two of them, and I put it out on social media and had people vote for it. And it was really 50-50, but then when my daughter posted it on her social media, my older daughter, and she had people vote on it, all mostly young adults,
uh-huh.
you know, 18 to 26 or so,
right.
and they all voted for this cover.
Oh,
and so I was like, okay, that's my beta market, so... We're going for that.
So let's just describe the cover. So
it's a rainbow with a young man's face, and he is just, you know, some picture of someone who is pulled off.
Right.
Shutterstock or
right.
whatever.
Right, and he looks like he could be one of these characters.
He looks like he could be one of the characters, and his face, the rainbow, his face is sort of disjointed.
Right.
And so I think it just sort of leads you to think like some things are not lining up.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Which is what I really love about it.
Great. And then your daughter's illustrations. There aren't a lot of illustrations in the book,
three.
But the sections have them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you tell her what you wanted, or did she just do that from what she read?
I just gave her the fables, and I said, can you do a illustration for each of the fables? She's headed off to college this fall to study illustration.
Okay.
And so she was pretty excited to have a few illustrations published before she even goes off to study it.
So wonderful.
That's great.
That's great. Okay. And then I always ask my guests if they've read any books lately that they might want to recommend to listeners who love to read.
Yeah. So books I have read lately. I have a lot of books between Kindle and Audible and then sitting on my nightstand. But I chose three. One that I'm currently reading is Beneath a Scarlet Sky by Mark Sullivan.
Okay.
We're listening to that on Audible. Actually, it's a lovely book about a young man, Italian man during World War II.
Okay.
Who ends up as a driver for one of the Nazi generals.
Oh, okay.
And it's fascinating. I really love stories about World War II.
Yeah, and it's fiction.
It's fiction.
And is it? And it's well read.
Based on a story, actually.
Oh, okay.
That is real.
Oh, okay.
But yes, it's very well read. Great, great Audible story. And then I just read the advanced reader copy of Coming of Age by Madeline Kunin.
Oh, good.
I was at down in Boston at the Book Expo with Governor Kunin and had the opportunity to get a signed copy from her. And I was planning to give it to my mother-in-law. And I was like, oh, I should read it before I give it to her. And it was lovely.
Yeah.
It really was a lovely
book.
She's
a wonderful writer. She's going to be on the show in September with that book.
That's great. So I won't give anything away. Great book, though.
Okay.
And then the third book I wanted to mention, which is... So my daughters and I are really obsessed right now with The Handmaid's Tale on Netflix. And I had read it years and years ago back in college and decided to reread that. So I just finished that and was, you know, really enjoyed again, sort of seeing it now come to life.
Yeah.
In Netflix.
And it's funny because I am I'm pretty hard on any sort of movie or TV adaptation. And I feel like they've done an amazing job. The first season of that book so represented the book, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. And then I was like in season two going, how is this possible?
Right.
The book, right? It launches into its own story, but it keeps it so consistent.
Right.
So.
But I do believe that she's an advising producer.
Yes.
And she's actually in the first show. Did you ever notice that?
No.
Yeah, Margaret Atwood makes a cameo appearance.
I might have to rewatch.
The training center.
Yeah.
What about you, Sarah? What are you working on next?
So I have another book that I'm probably going to start outlining and sketching over the next month, as soon as this one launches.
Yes.
And kind of gets rolling. And I'm not really sure. I think it'll probably be young adult again because that seems to be where my heart lies in terms of writing. But I'm have a story that I've been thinking about that has immigration and trafficking and several issues, and it's sort of based on a few people that I worked with many years ago.
Okay.
So it wouldn't be their story, but, you know, loosely based on some of those challenges and situations, and I think also timely as to what's happening in our current climate.
Yeah. All right, that sounds interesting too, and I know that while you're doing your book tour, you're not going to be able to do a lot of
writing. I'll just be sketching a few scenes here and there to just keep going.
Yeah. Right. Now, are you traveling at all for your book tour? Is it mostly?
I am going down to D.C. actually.
Oh, that's exciting.
Not this coming weekend, but the following weekend, I'm going to the Outright Lit Fest.
Yeah, yeah.
In D.C. and I'll be selling books down there. So
fantastic!
Excited.
Okay. All right. Great. So I love how you depict teenage awkwardness in this book, and I, you know, that's kind of a, I guess that the way I just put it is kind of a cliche, and it's much more textured than that, but we all are familiar with what it feels like to be that age. To me, your book felt very real. I'm just going to mention a couple of scenes. In a scene in which Jonathan has gotten into a fight, his mother clearly wants to talk to him, but she picks up on his discomfort and his need to be left alone, and she stays with him, but just offers quiet support without pushing. It's such a great scene. Actually, that's the only scene I'm going to mention right now. I don't want to give anything away, but it's a wonderful scene. And the awkwardness of those years is really well drawn. Now, this question doesn't necessarily have to be about that. You can go with it wherever you want. But I wonder if you can offer some advice for writing for a young adult reader.
I think that really knowing your character mm-hmm. is so well, right? Like knowing what they're struggling with and developmentally mm-hmm. and emotionally. I think the great thing about writing for young adults is for many of us, I think many adults read young adult literature as well, yeah. right? And we love it because
they've discovered how much of a pleasure that is.
Yeah, it brings you back, yeah. right? We've been there.
Right.
And they are the group that I think is really challenging the current status, right?
Yes.
They're always like trying to figure out what the current adults are doing wrong and how they could make things better,
yes.
right? And they have hope and they have like a desire for things to get better. And so I think for me, writing for this age group is really about capturing that
yes.
and really like challenging the status quo, challenging how things happen and being willing to dig into that and mm-hmm. not be afraid. I think for anyone who's writing for young adults, sometimes people think they want fantasy or they just want something that is, you know, a quick story that is Netflix worthy or,
yeah.
or something that is done about vampires or dragons or whatever fantasy in some way, but I sort of disagree. Not that that isn't entertaining. I love J.R.R. Tolkien and
right.
Harry Potter. I love those books. And I really feel like kids are sort of craving stories about real life.
Yeah.
Right? What is happening? What's happening in their world? They want to see themselves. They want to see kids working through some of the challenges they're facing and have the opportunity to see how. What do you do?
Right.
How can you take the next step? And so I don't think we should shy away from really challenging subjects in YA. I think it's an opportunity to put it out there, and that's how we learn and grow as
right.
individuals, is often through our reading and our connection to characters. So I think we should give them those characters to connect with.
Right, and they're having to deal with some things that I'll speak for my generation. I think I'm a little older than you are, but I feel like we didn't have to deal with that stuff, not to the extent that they do today. And so it seems not very honest to not share that in their literature as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my last question about Aesop Lake, but I did want to just ask you, every week on the show, I offer a writing prompt for listeners who are writers who might like a jumping off point when they get stuck in their work, and I wonder if you might have anything to suggest.
I do.
Yay.
So I was thinking about this. In my writing, one of the things that I always try to do, and I think this prompt is really critical for anybody's writing, but I think there's often a villain
mm-hmm.
or there's somebody who's not the good guy. And we always want to tell the good guy's story, right?
Yes.
And so my prompt is really to choose a villain either from your own fiction or from someone that in a story you can think of. And of course, you know, Harry Potter is what came to my mind just recently. So I would say like Malfoy,
right?
Like we know a lot about Voldemort's history, but what do we really know about Malfoy's history? Like
yeah.
why is he kind of a jerk?
Yeah.
And so I would say choose someone like Malfoy or some other sort of not so nice character, either from your own fiction or from a fictional story you're familiar with, and then really write their backstory.
Oh, that's
like,
great.
Why are they the way they are? What drives them? What got them to the place of anger or deception? Like, I would love to know, like, what do people think? Why is Malfoy kind of, I mean, he has two parents and a lot of money, so what's his problem?
Right.
right? Why isn't he just a nice guy who has a lot of money? And instead, he's got this really dark side.
Yes.
And so I would want to know, like, what is it?
Right. And that, it's funny, that really relates back to something we said a little while ago. Neither of your main characters is a bad guy. They're both good guys coming at the same story from different sides. But as we mentioned, they don't know each other's stories. And so right. It makes them misunderstand each other. And I think that's a great prompt.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. That's wonderful. I want to mention one more time that I've been talking to Sarah Ward, and the novel that she is releasing tomorrow night at the Phoenix Bookstore in Burlington, Vermont at 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
is called Aesop Lake. It's published by Green Writers Press, which is also a Vermont press.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I just want to mention that while we've been here since 3 o'clock, we've had a DJ in the studio named Athena Kafantaris.
Kafantaris. Yep, you got it.
Athena is with me in the studio today, kind of getting the feel of how things work here. And she's going to have a show coming up soon on Fridays from 11 to 2. And I thought I would just ask her to say a little bit about what she's going to be doing.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So my radio show is called Throat of the Loon. And it basically explores a narrative through song and through movie clips, dialogue, and different audio sources. I basically am doing an expansion of performance art backing tracks.
Okay.
So I thought that what traditionally is a half an hour performance or a 15-minute performance would translate very well to a longer format.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty excited to get on the air.
I'm excited to hear it. It sounds really interesting.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always made sort of mixtapes or playlists throughout my life that include more than just music. And I love stories.
Yeah.
And so to be able to tell a story with music and audio clips and let the listener kind of figure out what the thread is that ties everything together and get interpretations of what they experience emotionally in listening to the story.
Oh, that's so cool. Wonderful. Yeah. And I think a perfect example of how creative community radio can be. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show, news about book-related events that I can announce on the Bookworm's calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. And I hope that you have a great week.